Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. When I used to smoke, I was really worried about my health. I mean, not right away, but a few years into it. Every time I lit up, which was often, I thought, oh man, this is so bad for me. I have to quit. I've never been worried in the same way about alcohol. During the pandemic, weekday cocktails became a thing as a way to celebrate that we had made it through yet another long day. And I never wondered, is this hurting my health? A lot of people I know actually believe that drinking a little is good for you, lowers your cholesterol, protects your heart. We've heard that on the news.
A new study finds red wine can improve heart health.
Now there may be even more reason to raise a glass.
Those that drank or drink half a bottle of wine were less likely to be obese.
French people are healthy. They drink, right? I mean, we all know that drinking a lot is bad for you. Liver disease, addiction, accidents. But is moderate drinking really healthy?
It just kind of never completely made sense to me.
That's New York Times health reporter Rani Rabin. She wondered where this idea came from, that drinking a little bit is not only not bad, but actually better for you than not drinking at all. The first big study to argue that moderate drinkers live longer was published in the 1920s by biologist Raymond Pearl,
who plotted on a graph longevity of people and whether they were heavy or moderate drinkers. And he found this U-shaped curve. The people who drank a lot were definitely dying in higher numbers. They died younger.
The people who didn't drink at all, the teetotalers, also died younger. But
the people who drank a little were kind of had the best longevity.
And if you look around now, 100 years later, this idea is still pretty pervasive. Information on health sites is either vague or slightly in favor of moderate drinking.
1 to 2 drinks a day for a man is considered healthy. 1 drink a day for a woman, that's fine. That's 7 drinks a week. That's good.
Rani says as she looked into the science and research studies supporting this claim, she saw connections that gave her pause.
There's a lot of money going as financial, as academic grants to researchers from groups that were funded by the alcohol industry. They were giving grants for research. They were funding professorships. They were funding conferences on the health benefits of alcohol.
What do we really know about drinking, especially in moderation? And can we trust the science? On this episode, we look into the impact of alcohol on our health. How has the pandemic affected our drinking habits? And could a new substance be a game changer? Let's start with moderate drinking. A couple of years ago, Rani Rabin was excited to see that a big study was starting up to look into the health impact.
And it would have been the last word. It would have been the last word on the subject because no one's going to come up with this money and do this again.
But that is not what happened. Liz Tung takes it from here.
David Jernigan's a well-known alcohol researcher, respected and relatively outspoken. Though by the time we'd finished talking, he seemed a bit apprehensive about sharing his story.
I've probably shot down half my career by by giving this interview, but I believe in science.
David worked at Johns Hopkins for years. Now he's at Boston University.
I've worked on alcohol policy issues at every level imaginable for the last 34 years.
In 2014, David and his colleague Mike Siegel were flying high. They'd recently wrapped up a blockbuster research project, the first ever national study of how alcohol branding affects young people's drinking habits.
And we got amazing data. We published more than 30 papers out of that one study that is a very, very fertile study.
Among their findings were which brands of alcohol young people consume the most, which ones they're most likely to binge drink, and evidence that many of these products are heavily advertised. The last point especially generated a flurry of news stories, drawing a direct connection between alcohol advertising and underage drinking. That's not exactly what the research showed. It showed correlation, not causation, which David says they were careful to point out.
So we weren't making any of those statements, but as I say, we don't write the headlines.
It was in the wake of all this attention that David and Mike got a call from the organization funding their research, the NIAAA, or National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, which is part of the National Institutes of Health.
So I got a call from my project officer saying, the director wants to meet with you.
Getting called in to meet the director, in person no less, was unusual to say the least, and kind of a big deal. Because in the land of alcohol research, David says, the NIAAA is super important.
So if you want to do work on alcohol, NIAAA is the giant funder.
So in January of 2015, they traveled down to the NIAAA's headquarters in Rockville, Maryland, with a stack of their research in tow.
We walked in and the director was there.
George Koob.
As was his deputy at the time. And two of the leading sort of house scientists.
David says he and Mike had assumed that the point of the meeting was to go over their findings and make sure they weren't getting overblown by the media. So Mike launched into an enthusiastic PowerPoint presentation about the research.
And my recollection is about halfway through the meeting, about 30 minutes in, the director basically lost it. And he jumped up from his chair and said, and I quote, "I don't f***ing care about alcohol advertising."
David and Mike were stunned, partly because George Koob was yelling obscenities at them, but also because he seemed to have zero interest in their findings or how they got there. Instead, he just insisted there was no relationship between advertising and underage drinking. Mike shoved the stack of their research back towards George Koob.
And said, "Look, this is our science. You cannot deny the science."
After a while, they managed to dial things back. But George Koob never backed down. Before David and Mike left, he gave them a warning.
"If you submit another grant and it gets a good enough score, I will fund it, but that's the last thing I'm going to fund on alcohol advertising."
The meeting left David and Mike in shock. They knew they were doing good science. Science that could actually help change the bigger policy picture. So why was the head of the NIAAA, which is supposed to be a leader in the field of alcohol research, seemingly so opposed to their work? It would take David and Mike another few years to find out what was going on behind the scenes. A revelation that would come in part from New York Times health reporter Ronnie Rubin. Fast forward a couple years to 2017. Ronnie was covering an exciting new study. It was called the MOC trial, which stands for Moderate Alcohol and Cardiovascular Health. It was this huge randomized control trial that was designed to tell us how moderate drinking affects our health, specifically whether it raises or lowers people's chance of stroke, heart attack, diabetes, and death. It was a big deal, not only because it was going to resolve this long-running debate about whether or not moderate drinking is good for you or not, but because it was being run by the National Institutes of Health.
Which was like, you know, the NIH, you know, they're unbiased. They do research for research's sake.
There was just one problem.
It turned out the NIH wasn't really paying for it. The alcohol industry was paying for it.
Now, this isn't so unusual. Over the years, shrinking funds have led the NIH to do a number of collaborations with industry. They even have a special foundation that handles the funds and creates a sort of firewall between researchers and the industry. But Ronnie was suspicious.
Because we know that when industry funds research, they usually get results that they want to see. They're not going to give $100 million to a study that says alcohol is bad for you.
The funding ended up being a major focus of Ronnie's article. But in interviews, the head of the NIAAA, George Koob, assured Ronnie that the money was given with no strings attached. The study's principal investigator was even more adamant.
And I quoted Dr. Kenneth Mickelmull, who was the principal investigator at Harvard, saying that he had had literally no contact with anyone in the alcohol industry about it. It was a good old-fashioned NIH trial.
The story ran in the New York Times on July 3rd, 2017.
And a few days later, I got a phone call from a tipster saying, "That is the biggest lie I ever heard. He had tons of contact with the alcohol industry."
Ronnie's never said who the tipster was, Suffice it to say, they were somebody who worked with the NIH and was personally involved in setting up the trial and its funding. And the tipster said, not only had Kenneth Mukamal had contact with the alcohol industry, he directly pitched them the trial.
He courted them. He went all over the country. He went to Philadelphia to beer convention, and he went to Palm Beach, Florida for a distilled spirits conference, and he went to D.C. to the lobbying group there, and he told them about the research.
And he convinced them to sponsor the study. It was potentially a major scoop. The question was, how could Ronnie figure out if it was true? She decided to start with Kenneth Mukamal, see if he really had made all those trips. So she sent in a Freedom of Information Act request to the NIH for emails related to Mukamal's travels. And then she waited. In the meantime, someone else was also filing Freedom of Information requests for NIAAA emails. Alcohol researcher Mike Siegel. In the 2 years since he and David Jernigan had that fateful meeting with George Kube, Kube had kept his vow not to fund any more of their advertising research projects. Here's David.
I mean, we had a smaller grant that we put in that got a very good score. It was never funded, and the program officer said to me on the phone, I'm embarrassed by this. I'm going to be embarrassed by this at council meeting after council meeting because it's going to keep coming up, and it will not be funded. The implication being it will not be funded because the director doesn't like it.
They'd still never figured out why, but Mike had a suspicion. He wrote to me in an email, I just suspected he was being influenced by the alcohol industry. In addition, many of the arguments he used in that meeting were directly taken from the alcohol industry party line. It was just a hunch, but I wanted to find out for sure. Eventually, David and Mike got back 120 pages of emails, including one from George Kube to a senior official at the Distilled Spirits Council, an industry group, sent 2 months before their meeting. In the email, George Kube wrote, for the record, this will not happen again. I will not be funding this kind of work under my tenure. Even now, a couple years later, David is still floored by what they found.
That's not the way things are supposed to work. This is supposed to be an objective, peer-reviewed process where the science carries the day. And it still leaves me somewhat speechless.
The email confirmed their suspicions, but it still didn't explain why George Kube was trying to keep alcohol bigwigs happy. So David and Mike approached somebody who might know, someone who they knew was already on the case, New York Times reporter Ronnie Rubin. By that time, Ronnie had received the documents from her own Freedom of Information request for her behind-the-scenes report on the big clinical trial on moderate drinking, and the pieces were falling into place. She found emails that confirmed Kenneth Mukamal's trips to meet alcohol industry reps. There were emails from NIAAA officials appealing for industry funding, but some of the most damning evidence came from Ronnie's tipster, a slideshow that Kenneth Mukamal had used in one of his presentations to the alcohol industry. In it, he promised specific findings for a study that hadn't yet happened. One of the slides read, a definitive clinical trial represents a unique opportunity to show that moderate alcohol consumption is safe and lowers the risk of certain diseases. Another bullet point was, that level of evidence is necessary if alcohol is ever to be recommended as part of a healthy diet in clinical practice.
You know, doctors need this level of evidence from a randomized controlled trial, and this is going to be what we find. So that was really kind of the smoking gun.
Later on, another email came out between Kenneth Mukamal and an NIAAA higher-up that included the bullet point, one of the important findings will be showing that moderate drinking is safe. When Ronnie asked Kenneth Mukamal about it, he denied that he was soliciting money, said the quotes were taken out of context. Ronnie remembers he stayed cool in their conversation, if vague. George Kube, on the other hand.
He screamed at me, actually, when I asked him about the trial and whether the trial was sound and whether the funding wasn't inappropriate. And he really raised his voice. He was really screaming, and he said, we do things right at the NIH.
What he didn't do was offer a meaningful response to the substance of Ronnie's questions, mainly about whether the study had been compromised by the investigators' communications with the industry. He just stayed adamant that the NIH does things right. And, Ronnie says, acted like she was out of line to even question it. George Kube, by the way, declined to speak to me for this story. Kenneth Mugamal never responded to my request for an interview. Ronnie put everything she found in a bombshell article that ran on the front page of the New York Times on March 17th, 2018. It made a major splash, but even so.
I have to say, I never expected what happened next.
3 days after Ronnie's article came out, the head of the NIH, Francis Collins, ordered an investigation into the mock trial. A few months later, they suspended enrollment.
And June 15th, Francis Collins shut the trial down.
It was a historic end to what might have been a historic study. And it all happened with breathtaking speed. Over the following months, the NIH released the results of its investigations, which were exhaustive and pulled no punches. The mock trial was a black mark on the name of the NIH. So what about the actual question that the mock trial was asking? About whether there are any health benefits to moderate drinking? Ronnie says sometimes she still feels guilty about that.
There were some bloggers who said, now that the study's ended and they pulled the plug on it, we're never gonna know.
So instead, I reached out to Thomas Babor. He's a veteran alcohol researcher who spent years working with the NIH and NIAAA. I asked him what he thought about the mock trial's question, whether moderate drinking is helpful or harmful to your health.
It, I think, is a legitimate research question to ask.
Legitimate, that is, when it's formulated properly and not with the help of the alcohol industry. But Thomas says if you look at the basis for this hypothesis, that alcohol is good for your health, you can make a pretty good guess at the answer.
If you believe those data that people who drink moderately live longer because there are about 15 or 20 diseases that they don't get, if you believe that, then you would have to postulate a mechanism that would make alcohol one of the most effective therapeutic agents known to humankind.
A mechanism capable of preventing cancer and heart disease and diabetes, among other diseases, which Thomas says is pretty unlikely. In other words, under scrutiny, the evidence for alcohol's beneficial effects is not super strong. Thomas adds, we don't necessarily need some big dramatic study to answer these questions, because most of the time, that's not how science works.
Research often is never definitive. It evolves over time, and that is the beauty of the scientific process.
In fact, David Jernigan says that's what's been quietly happening in the background, slow, steady progress, that this year culminated in a recommendation from an advisory committee that federal dietary guidelines reduce the current daily alcohol limit for men from 2 drinks a day to 1. That might not sound like a huge deal, but David says that small moving of the needle represents a lot of progress on the back end.
The reason the dietary guidelines changed is because the science has gotten stronger. And that's what's supposed to happen. We're supposed to keep studying things and learning more about them and getting smarter. The risk was substantially higher at 2 drinks a day than at 1 drink a day. And that's why the guidelines changed. That's what's supposed to happen. That's not political, that's the science.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. Even if you're not really worried about the long-term health risks of drinking, like heart disease or certain cancers, there is the immediate impact of feeling terrible the next day when you've had too much the night before. Could synthetic alcohol deliver some of the fun without the awful hangover? Claire Wiley has more.
Deep in the English countryside, over a hill and through an apple orchard, there's an underground lab. Yes, literally a secret lab, where a top brain scientist is hard at work on synthetic alcohol. And he's been testing it on himself.
You feel a bit more relaxed and you start to get a bit chattier, and your friends around the table say, shut up, Nut, you're saying too much, and then you know it's definitely working.
This is David Nutt, professor of neuropsychopharmacology at Imperial College London. He's got a bit of a reputation. In the late 2000s, David was the UK government's drugs advisor, but he got fired in 2009 for saying that alcohol is more dangerous than ecstasy or LSD. The next year, he published a study showing that booze is more harmful to society than heroin or crack.
As a doctor, you're always confronted by the problems of alcohol. Every time you go on the ward, you'll see someone who's been damaged by alcohol. So I've always wanted to give young people an alternative to this addictive, toxic substance, which in the end could, will kill 3.5 million people a year prematurely.
This alternative he's working on now is called Alkarel. It's a molecular compound, and it'll be used in all kinds of drinks instead of alcohol. David says Alkarel will allow you to feel the good effects of booze, but, and now here's the fun part, with no hangover.
Over the last 50 years, neuroscience has made major progress in understanding what alcohol does in the brain.
When we drink, alcohol affects a neurotransmitter in our brains. The booze binds to certain receptors, and that makes us feel buzzed or confident or sleepy.
And that means that you can potentially target subtypes of that receptor to get the beneficial effects of alcohol and avoid the subtypes which give you the negative effects, like excessive intoxication, like dependence, like withdrawal, etc.
So for the past 10 years, David and his team have been developing and testing compounds that target extremely specific brain receptors to get a desired response. You'll feel relaxed, chatty, even less anxious, but not reckless.
Alcohol is the great social drug. So what we are targeting is for people to lose the inhibitions around being sociable, but we don't want them to lose their self-control.
That's the thing about Alkarel. You cannot get drunk on it, no matter how much you drink. They're designing the molecule so that the effect plateaus. It'll be like you've had one or two glasses of wine. So no Alkarel tequila slammers. And what about this promised land of a hangover-free Monday? Well, first of all, you'll only consume a tiny amount of the compound, much less than alcohol. And secondly, when we drink booze, our livers transform it into a toxic compound called acetaldehyde, which leads to hangovers. That won't happen with Alkarel.
Alkarel is specifically targeted to have no effects on the body. We're trying to eliminate all interactions with the liver or the kidneys or the gut.
But not everyone sees the potential of an alternative to alcohol.
I don't think the premise that we can fully separate the positive and negative effects of a synthetic substance on the brain can be fully supported by what we know about brain function, alcohol, and addiction.
That's Sarah Zemor, senior scientist at the Alcohol Research Group, a public health institute nonprofit based in California. She's not convinced that Alkarel will work.
They're targeting sociability and relaxation, but relaxation, I mean, how do you do that without targeting disinhibition? I can't imagine how you could achieve those effects without disinhibiting a person. And so if that happens, then people are prone to make risky and poor decisions, just as they do with alcohol. So they may be more likely to engage in unsafe behaviors, unsafe sex, violence and criminal activity, or behaviors that are simply dangerous.
We're a few years away from being able to order a drink with Alkarel in it. The compound first needs to go through lots of rigorous safety testing. So, would people prefer a drink with Alkarel instead of a couple of beers? Sure, you might miss the flavor of your favorite lager or Merlot, but would the trade-offs be worth it? I got a bunch of my friends together for a socially distanced happy hour to find out. Here's Jared Simpson.
Well, if you're not really losing control and you're not really getting that heady kind of thing, are you really getting drunk? Is it the same thing? So, I mean, I would try it. I mean, I'd try anything. But would it ever be a replacement? I don't know.
From the point of view of just the tipsiness being like just a little bit of softness.
That's Christine Frost, another friend of mine.
You know, not being so kind of consumed with all of the stuff that we're dealing with. If we could just kind of knock that edge off reality at the moment, I think it's great.
I'm definitely intrigued by synthetic alcohol. But personally, I can't shake the idea that there's some kind of catch. We go too hard on the margaritas, we get hungover. We eat too many carbs. We put on weight. It seems like everything pleasurable has a consequence. And maybe that's to keep us in check. Because isn't part of the allure of alcohol the risk of losing control? The temptation of one more drink at the bar? The sense that anything might happen?
That was Claire Wiley reporting. We're talking about the impact of alcohol on our health. I don't know about you, but I'm definitely more clumsy when I'm a little bit buzzed, tripping over a chair, dropping a glass, that kind of thing. And when you look at national statistics, alcohol plays a role in all kinds of accidents and injuries. So I was pretty surprised to hear that there was once a Swedish Olympian who was disqualified for doping, in his case, drinking two beers, which he did as a way to enhance his performance.
The proper name is Hans Gunnar Liljenvall. Anybody who has studied sports history has run into him.
That's historian Björn Sandahl. He says Hans Gunnar competed as a pentathlete at the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City.
The Olympic torch for the first time reached Latin America.
Pentathlon is this very long and kind of strange event that involves running, swimming, horseback riding, fencing, and if all of that isn't enough, pistol marksmanship.
Well, there is a Swedish saying that alcohol strengthens the hand. In the press coverage from this event, it was said that it was a way to soothe the nerves. There was an idea that you got a more steady hand if you had some alcohol in your body.
So Hans and the entire Swedish pentathlon team got disqualified after having won the bronze. But is there any truth to this idea that alcohol can actually make you better at certain things? Jads Lehmann explains the surprising link between alcohol and performance improvement.
So before I was a public radio reporter, I was a Marine. And Marines are famously good marksmen. We were trained to hit a man-sized target from 5 football fields away without using any kind of scope, just the regular iron sights on the gun. I was a pretty good shot, so at some point I became a combat marksmanship coach, which basically meant I went around on rifle ranges and helped other Marines improve.
And the fire line's ready. Shooters, stand by.
I learned very quickly that to be a good shot, you have to be really, really chill. The most relaxed Marine is the deadliest. I remember my shooters would be lying down for the last furthest shots of the range, and often I'd crawl up right beside them and I'd almost whisper, "Relax your back, shoulders. Relax those legs. Are you tense in your arms? Take a deep breath." So, okay, while alcohol and guns are obviously a dangerous combination that you probably shouldn't try at home or anywhere, I can see how drinking a little bit could give you that edge.
In the people who do surgery microsurgery in particular, as I did, do know that you've got a natural tremor when you're under a microscope.
That's Olivier Rabin, science director of the World Anti-Doping Agency. Before that, he used to study the vasculature of the brain. He worked under a microscope, catheterizing tiny blood vessels in animals.
And you can see that when you take forceps, for example, it's very well known by many surgeons, that you can see the little movements. This is a physiological movement. This is natural due to the contraction of the muscles.
Low-dose alcohol gets rid of those tremors somehow.
I'm not sure the mechanism is completely known because alcohol acts, as you can imagine, at the central nervous system level. And there is a control by a nucleus in the brain controlling tremors. And apparently alcohol would act directly or indirectly on this nucleus.
Olivier actually approached shooting organizations and asked, "Hey, do you want us to do a study on alcohol and shooting and see if it really improves performance or not?"
But in the end, they were very convinced that it could be an issue in their sport, and they didn't find it very useful to conduct such a thorough study.
Basically, the advantage was so obvious to professional shooters that they thought the study would be a waste of time. So I kept digging into this idea of alcohol as a performance enhancer, and I found an entirely different kind of skill where alcohol could help you out. It's a type of cognition that requires quick and creative thinking.
Each one, change one letter to two new letters to name a country. For example, if I said Bell, B-E-L-L-E, you would say Belize, changing the second L to I-Z.
That's NPR puzzle master Will Shortz puzzling listeners on the air. To solve these puzzles, you need to think creatively instead of going through a step-by-step process, like when you're solving a math problem. And often, the answer seems to just pop up all of a sudden.
Okay, number one is fence, F-E-N-C-E.
France.
Excellent. Number two is...
How does that happen? Andrew Giraz is a cognition researcher who studied this type of thing.
These problems where clearly you're capable of solving it because you got to the right answer eventually. And it's often not clear how you got to the answers.
Andrew and his team wanted to see if alcohol makes you better at this. They used something called a remote associates test.
That's a very common test of creative problem solving. And so in that, we give you three different words, and you have to find a fourth word that forms a phrase with each of those three words. So if I give you the words duck, dollar, and fold, your job is to find a word that fits with all three of those. So the answer in this case would be bill. Duck bill, dollar bill, billfold.
They lined up their test subjects in the lab, and one group stayed sober while the other got vodka cranberries.
The nice thing about that is you can vary the dosage that you're giving to people, and it's not really clear how much alcohol is in the drink.
Okay, that's not always true, but I'm assuming Andrew used pretty good vodka. He tells me at first he basically just had subjects sitting there drinking silently.
I'm just picturing like some Soviet hellscape, just people silently drinking vodka in a lab.
Right, that's what we wanted to avoid, hence allowing them to watch a movie in the meantime.
The movie, by the way, was Ratatouille. They got to watch that as they sipped their cocktails, and then when everyone was just about the legal limit for driving, close to 0.08, they started taking these tests. And the folks that had a bit of a buzz going scored substantially higher than their sober counterparts, but that's not even the most interesting part.
Not only were they solving more of these problems, they were solving them faster than the sober individuals.
The answers were just coming to them, not after going through a whole bunch of steps, trying to think of every single word that goes with duck, but effortlessly. Andrew thinks what's going on is that alcohol is disrupting their working memory.
If you're trying to, you know, write down a phone number while someone's talking to you, you're trying to focus on writing the number, you're remembering the numbers that they're saying, and then they keep talking about other things as they keep going. All of that stuff, your ability to continue to hold on to those numbers you need to remember while other things are happening, that's working memory.
Top-tier working memory is like when you see someone in the UN translating one diplomat's Japanese into English in real time. Alcohol disrupts working memory by disrupting your attention capacity. It's hard to focus on multiple things when you're a bit drunk. That also makes it hard for you to get stuck on things, like, for instance, trying to figure out all the possible words that could go with the word duck. Your mind wanders in a disordered way, and it wanders, it turns out, right up to that creative solution that the creative problem demanded.
I know there's a saying, write drunk, edit sober. It's usually attributed to Hemingway. I don't think he actually said it. But, you know, that kind of idea of getting to the ideas and then coming back after the fact and formulating them when you are able to focus a little bit more makes sense to me.
There's, of course, limits to this. You get too drunk and creative or traditional problem solving, they both get worse. And there's other studies that measure different kinds of creativity that show alcohol diminishing ability. But if you're having trouble wrapping the second act of your play, or you can't figure out how to end a radio script on performance-enhancing booze, maybe crack a cold one. It might just come to you. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
Coming up, when drinking a lot is what your town is best known for.
It is a way of life here. It really is.
And then a pandemic crashes the party. Still to come on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the health impact of drinking. The pandemic has lots of people questioning their relationship with alcohol and whether it's healthy. In Key West, Florida, those questions are discussed on a broader level. This is a hard-drinking town. Its reputation as a place where anything goes has helped build a billion-dollar tourism industry. But like everywhere, coronavirus has closed bars and limited social gatherings. So will the pandemic change this place forever? Nancy Klinginer has this look at the party town's history and future.
Like a lot of people, Dawn Wilder first saw Key West as a tourist.
I remember coming down here on vacation with my husband and our friends, and oh my goodness, we drank far more than we ever did back home.
When she moved here, she realized it wasn't only the tourists who drank a lot. Drinking during the day and drinking every day is pretty normal here.
It's called Key's disease, and a lot of people wear it as a badge. It's not necessarily looked upon as bad.
In 2001, after living here for a couple years, she got her dream job, singing at a bar called The Bull. It's on Duval Street, the main tourist drag, lined with shops and art galleries, and lots of bars. But getting her dream job also led to a lot of stress, and she was going through a divorce.
The next thing you know, it's like, send me up a shot of tequila, and then somebody says, can I buy you a shot, another shot of tequila, and It's just so easy.
After a few months, Dawn saw that she was getting erratic and irresponsible, saying inappropriate things on stage and getting belligerent with a manager. She started going to meetings and stopped drinking. But you kept working in a bar.
It's frowned upon, to be honest. People are like, oh my God, how are you going to work in a bar? And it's dangerous and you'll end up drinking.
Dawn hasn't. She's been sober for more than 18 years. But she still has a front row seat where she sees the regulars, the constant parade of tourists drinking much more than they do at home, and sometimes people who have tried to get sober and started drinking again. John Vagnoni hitchhiked down the Keys in 1973, then took a city bus into town.
It dropped me off right at the Green Parrot. So I stepped off the city bus and into the Green Parrot, the first place I stepped into.
John started tending bar there. Back in the 70s, it wasn't tourists filling the bars in Key West.
The clientele was pretty much hippies and sailors because there was still Navy there.
The Navy closed most of their operations in town. In the 80s, John became a partner in the Green Parrot. Also in the 80s, the old narrow bridges that spanned the Keys were replaced with a new, wider, safer version of the Overseas Highway. That opened the way for big-time tourism. Another guy who got to the Keys around the same time as John had come up with a new nickname for the city.
Nibbling on sponge cake. Watching the sun bake.
In 1987, he opened a restaurant named after his island anthem. The bar scene
went from the military to Margaritaville.
Terry Johnston came to Key West for the weather 22 years ago.
We sold everything. We didn't care if we built screened-in porches and bathrooms. We were coming to Key West and be warm.
Terry eventually got involved in local politics after Hurricane Wilma in 2005. And now Terry's the mayor, presiding during the pandemic when she's had to make tough calls, especially over the summer, about closing bars, limiting alcohol sales, and ordering people to wear masks whenever they leave their home or hotel room.
The last thing that we want is for a spike to set us back for the rest of the year, and particularly through the holiday season.
Even when bars were takeout only and alcohol sales stopped at midnight, the tourists kept coming. Now that most of the restrictions have been lifted, some on the island are just hoping to make it through and get back to where they were. But others, including Terry, think it's time to reevaluate the high-volume, hard-partying approach to tourism. The pandemic hasn't just changed Key West, Terry says. It's changed the whole world.
We're going to travel differently. We're going to travel for different reasons. Mass tourism and mass events, I think, are really going to struggle. I would be surprised if they ever came back the way that they were before the pandemic.
She says the city's prioritized the business brought by mass tourism over quality of life for the residents. and that the enforced break in daily happy hour meetups may wind up having some benefits for the health of Key Westers.
We've had great experiences and families have gotten closer and we've had more dinners and more interaction with people that are close to us. I think it's opened us up to maybe breaking some bad habits. And one of those maybe is that you don't have to head to happy hour every night.
Dawn Wilder, from her seat on stage at the Bowl, is skeptical that Key West can shed its hard drinking allure.
Do I think we'll have less people? Yes, but I mean, people are here, and the people that are coming because it's a party town. That's what they're here for.
John Bagnoni's seen the Parrot evolve from sailor and hippie bar to low-key local hangout to music venue that packs the place and has a gift shop attached.
I feel like we can adapt to almost anything, you know?
And he says the pandemic hasn't changed how he'll run the business for locals or tourists.
My whole business philosophy has always been not so much to try to sell people a drink as much as just to make them feel like they're part of something, like a tribe, you know, make them feel like they're part of the place.
That story was reported by Nancy Klingener. She is a reporter with WLRN in South Florida. We're talking about the health impact of alcohol. We often think of drinking as a way to connect to others, to have a toast, to celebrate, share a moment, you know, like at a wedding, graduation party, 50th anniversary. In many Native American communities, alcohol is banned at celebrations because drinking has had such a devastating impact there.
There's higher rates of mortality, morbidity for American Indians and Alaska Natives compared to other groups in the U.S.
That's Vivian Gonzalez. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. But she says you have to look beyond the numbers to get the whole picture.
And while there is a significant difference and a significant health disparity that needs to be addressed, it's really important, too, to consider that there's really high rates of alcohol use disorders among white Americans. So if we look at the rates of alcohol use disorder for white Americans based on large epidemiological studies, it's about 33% of people at some time in their life will have an alcohol use disorder.
Wow.
When we compare that to Native Americans, the rate is about 43%. So there is a difference, and it's significant. However, when we control for sociodemographic factors or socioeconomic factors, those differences largely disappear. This includes greater poverty, greater unemployment, lower attainment of formal education, greater exposure to trauma and stress, such as discrimination, more limited access to health care, and then the lasting effects of colonization. So things like forced assimilation, loss of culture, and disruption in traditional ways of coping with distress.
So Vivian says it's these factors that make alcohol so devastating. But a lot of people believe it's something else, biological or genetic reasons that Indigenous people are affected differently by alcohol, that they can't tolerate it or become quickly addicted to it. This has been called the firewater myth.
Not only people themselves believe this, treatment providers believe this.
Vivian says the myth goes all the way back to the beginnings of colonization. European trappers and traders introduced hard liquor and their drinking habits.
So these are folks who kind of literally and figuratively lived on the fringe of society. These were people who would, you know, go into the unknown to go trade and to make their living. And so they were introducing hard liquor, but then also modeling drinking that was not moderate. So if you could think about something new being introduced to your culture, it's being introduced in terms of how you then use that thing. And it was hard drinking.
Missionaries wrote back to Europe describing what they were seeing among Native people.
And what they were describing was a lot of honestly normal effects of intoxication. So, you know, people becoming violent or behaving in unruly ways. However, what the monks and missionaries were attributing this to is race as opposed to simply intoxication. And so the assumption was is that it was a constitutional difference. And if you think about the era that we're talking about, when there were afflictions or problems, there was this assumption that it was biological, it was due to race, and that there must be something inherently different for people who are Indigenous versus people from Europe.
How do you think this fire water myth has impacted indigenous people and their thinking about alcohol.
When you look at rates of abstinence in Native communities, they're the highest of almost any other cultural group in the U.S., with about 50% of people being abstinent. However, this idea of a biological vulnerability that's specific to American Indians and Alaska Natives, it's also, based on our research, contributing to a number of problems as well. It's associated with greater guilt for drinking small amounts of alcohol, greater depression, greater drinking to cope with negative affect, greater alcohol use and problems, lower confidence and ability to moderate drinking.
So there's a fear that may make the whole problem worse.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at the myth, what it suggests is that Native people either shouldn't drink or they should drink at their own peril. And that really cognitively sets the stage for being worried about your drinking before you've even had a drink. You're worried about it and potentially distressed.
That's Vivian Gonzalez. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Sobriety and maintaining it is a daily commitment for many people, and the pandemic has made it harder for some. Claire McInerney has this story from Austin, Texas.
Annabelle lives in Austin. She's been sober for 4 years, and the pandemic has not changed that.
I am so, so glad that I'm not drinking right now, because I would be drinking like crazy.
She asked us not to use her last name. Since the pandemic began, she's stayed connected with her sober community virtually.
Being alone and in a house and not in your world at work with your people, you know, is triggering in a lot of ways, where cravings crop up when they normally wouldn't.
And all this free time reminds her of a different point in her life.
I had a lot more idle time when I was drinking and drugging. And there's some kind of muscle memory that crops up of like, oh, you're painting your kitchen. Wouldn't that be so great with a bunch of amphetamines and the whole house would be painted by now?
Dealing with being alone and maintaining sobriety is something Kevin Dick is also grappling with.
The creeping anxiety that is happening because of this pandemic is huge. It hasn't necessarily pushed me to the brink of using, but it has reminded me that I need to deal with these feelings.
He's really missed going to AA meetings.
It's hard to put your finger on exactly what it gives you being there in that physical space, but now that it's been taken out from underneath us, I think we all are realizing just how important that aspect is. You hold hands at every meeting at the end. You hug people and you get physically close to people.
Now, he's relying on virtual Alcoholics Anonymous meetings.
If I notice these feelings creeping up, I can jump into a Zoom meeting, like an online AA meeting, anytime I want. That's kind of one thing that this has done that hasn't been available before, is like I can go on the internet and I can find a meeting, whether it's in Paris or whether it's here.
Even with 13 years of sobriety, I mean, this situation has been very tough. It's been challenging to find ways to connect.
That's Chris Marshall. He's the owner of Sands Bar, an alcohol-free bar in Austin. Before the pandemic, the bar was a venue for people to do all the things that happen at typical bars. Sing karaoke, meet up with friends, meet new people, without alcohol. It's been closed since the pandemic began, and having that in-person community disappear overnight was shocking to Chris. But he's hosted virtual events to stay connected to his community because he's not the only sober person struggling. He says some days that's hard because we're all living in a world that celebrates drinking during this time.
You see all the memes on social media about drinking, and people can get alcohol to go and deliver to their homes. But for me, all that is just a reassurance that what I'm doing and what I've been doing for the past 13 years is the right thing. Because I don't have to lean on a toxic substance to get through a hard situation.
His main advice to get through it, take it one day at a time.
Claire McInerney is a reporter for KUT in Austin, Texas. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yub, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.